It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some lawmakers are pushing for more military defense and security in outer space. We'll learn about legislation that would create a space corps.
First, it's been over 50 years since John F. Kennedy's assassination, and yesterday the government released a new trove of long classified documents, thanks in part to a law passed 25 years ago.
The document's release is in part a response to a push for more transparency. It'll take weeks for experts to mine through everything, but some hope the documents will quiet the conspiracies that have surrounded JFK's death for decades.
John Pollock is a history instructor and pop culture expert at Madison College. He's here to look at the significance of these documents and America's enduring fascination with what happened on November 22nd, 1963. John, good to have you back.
Good to be back, Rob.
One thing that's probably not going to happen in these documents, we're not going to open one up and say, aha, this is the thing that puts it all together.
Right, yeah. There's not going to be a letter from Fred Flintstone saying, yeah, I shot Kennedy. That's not going to be in there. No, what we're finding is, and from the documents that I took a quick look at this when it came out last night, and then the news services have been, you know, there are historians and journalists on board kind of sifting through things. So what we've got are like little kind of pieces of stuff. And when you think about the documents that are released, so they're from the FBI and the CIA mostly, there's some things from the State Department. These are all intelligence agencies. And so the definition of intelligence here is they're just trying to gather whatever comes in, any sort of anonymous tip, any kind of rumor, any kind of, you know, research that indicates there's something going on. It's all going to be captured. Now, anybody who's done a large-scale research process knows that a lot of the research you wind up doing is kind of noise. That you've got something and it doesn't add up and you can't figure it out and you're like, all right, that's an anomaly, and you put it aside. And so in this declassification, I think what we're seeing are some of the things that were kind of entertained and then sort of cast off. There was nothing to corroborate it, and it's kind of there. So for example, there's a letter, one of the British newspapers, I think it was in Cambridge, got this call shortly before Kennedy was shot that something big was going to happen in the United States. And so if you, and what I think is interesting about that documents is, like, depending on your mindset when you hear that, when you read that document, it's either like, all right, that's random, or it's, whoa, they knew. But all you have in the document is just what the document says. And so all we can really do is look at that and say, well, okay, you know, we don't know who made the phone call, and we don't know what the substance of it was exactly. And the person who made it, since we don't know them, we can't ask them for follow-up. What did you know at that point? So we just kind of look at it and we're like, well, huh. And we kind of move on.
Right. Maybe the same guy called a different newspaper a year earlier and said exactly the same thing, and then nothing happened.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, all of you who work in radio and people who work in other areas where you're dealing with the general public, you get some serious inquiries and stuff like that, and then you have bozos. And you don't, you know, the documents that are being released, we can't really tell, like, who are the sources being really taken seriously and what was the random information coming in.
Let's talk about the process here, why these documents hadn't been released yet and why they're being released now.
Well, that's actually a great question. And I think that's one that that a lot of historians, historians in general who work with, who work on American foreign policy, who work in fields where they're looking at U.S. government documents in large numbers, this is an ongoing issue. That from the perspective of historians, whether professional or amateur, you know, we want to know. That's what animates us to get into this field, is we want to know what happened, and we want to, you know, have as much access as possible. From the perspective of intelligence agencies, they're also trying to get knowledge. They're also trying to figure out what's going on, but they're also concerned with compromising their sources, with letting something out too soon that could cause problems on down the road. And so the intelligence agencies, and I would say increasingly across the federal government in general, there's more of a drive to classify more and more stuff just in case it should be an issue later. So you get those two forces coming at each other, and that's where you get this big delay over the Kennedy documents. That this year, as you pointed out in your intro, the law that Congress passed in 1992 said within 25 years, everything's got to be declassified, and that anniversary was yesterday. So the U.S. waited until the very, very end to declassify these, and still there was like a little asterisk in there that said if there's anything at that time that is judged to be of extreme importance to national security, that could jeopardize American interests domestically or abroad, then the president has the discretion to hold those back, which, you know, about 10% of the documents weren't released. There's around 300 documents that are still classified, and the agencies who created them have like 180 days to justify that decision. And then I guess that's in March, April. President Trump will sort of make the call, well, can this be declassified now, or does it have to remain redacted or classified or otherwise? So you get those two opposing forces, and, the government holds the documents, so they're going to have the advantage there, have the ability to hold on to things that look innocuous to us once they're released.
Talking to John Pollack from Madison College. He's a history instructor there, looking at the release of newly unclassified documents related to the JFK assassination. These documents, this investigation was very far-ranging. It included investigations into places like Cuba. That was one of the theories that there was somehow, this is a retaliation, a conspiracy theory, and something that was investigated. This was a retaliation for U.S. efforts against Castro. And in the release of these documents, there are some embarrassing things, I think, to the intelligence community. A plan to create some kind of exploding seashell and put it where Fidel Castro liked to go diving. Things that don't necessarily paint the intelligence community in the best light.
Well, and some of these things we kind of knew about. I mean, for years, historians have known about things that were proposed to take Castro out. And I think this is kind of another feature, aspect of classifying documents, is that a lot of them are kind of like they're briefings, they're brainstorming sessions that for people who are engaged in espionage and so on, and during the Cold War. So you've got your main strategies. All right, so plan A is this, and there's a plan B, and these things are well known. But the intelligence agencies, they get down into like what's plan C, what's plan D, what's plan E, in degrees of like less and less probable. So, you know, the stuff you're talking about, the shenanigans against Castro that were kind of proposed, those were not really close to fruition and so forth. They're kind of thrown out at a meeting. Someone maybe did a few days worth of research to discover, well, how would we build a realistic exploding seashell and how would we get that to Cuba and so forth before someone else pulled the plug on it and just like, that's a dumb idea. We're not doing that. But it was written down, and so it's preserved. So that's where, you know, for a long time it was, you know, you wouldn't want, in most industries, you wouldn't want somebody like ruffling through your trash pile. You wouldn't want somebody finding all the ideas that capturing all the emails that you started to send, and you're like, no, I can't say that to that person, and you delete it and you start over. And that's really some of the documents we're seeing now are those sort of early drafts, are those kind of ideas that were floated and discarded.
Now, this was a shocking event, and a lot of people looked for explanations. This is one of the most common topics for conspiracy theories over the years. I saw a breakdown by all these different demographics. This is one of the few things a lot of people agree on. A majority of people, almost any way you slice it, think that Lee Harvey Oswald was not a lone gunman. Can you talk about the ongoing persistence of different alternate theories of what happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think about the relationship between history and conspiracy theory as sort of like the difference between like road and off-road. That if you're trying to get from point A to point B, typically you're going to take a road to get there. Usually for most of us, it's like, well, we'll go the paved road. And then if we're going someplace remote and there's a shortcut that takes us on an unpaved road, we'll take that. And a conspiracy theory is kind of what happens. Well, what happens when there's no road? How do we blaze a trail based on no road at all? And so it's a very human kind of desire. It's the same kind of idea that motivates people to study history, is to figure out what happened. And in the case of John F. Kennedy, there was a president who had who was young, and although in his time he was not universally popular, he was about a standard president in terms of popularity as of November of 63, that about 55-60% of the country thought he was doing okay, and 40-45% thought, nah, maybe there's a better guy out there. But after he died, it seemed kind of senseless. There was no, Lee Harvey Oswald didn't release any kind of manifesto or rationale. No group took credit for it. And it just seemed kind of senseless and random. And people looked for some kind of story. Why is this? Why did this thing happen? And so I think that's where the conspiracies kind of came out of. And then when you've got that desire up against the kind of bureaucratic imperative to not let all the, half-hearted plans and uncertain evidence kind of float around out there, you have the effort to hold that back and so on. So that forces people to look harder for, well, why are they holding it back and where is the true story? And that's where conspiracy theory comes in.
As we wrap up, John, is this release of new documents going to do anything to quiet theories, conspiracy theories about the JFK assassination?
I don't think so, because I think conspiracy theory in its nature thrives on the absence of evidence. And so where in regular history you get more evidence and you can say, oh, OK, there was, you know, the FBI was concerned that was concerned about conspiracy theories coming out, and they were, and we now have documents that they were onto this thanks to what was just released. But in conspiracy theory, it's the absence of evidence that motivates it, that if you say, no, that's not the story, then that's proof that the real story is being covered up, that a conspiracy theory then is almost impossible to refute. Because whatever evidence you provide to the contrary, a dyed-in-the-wool conspiracist will say, no, 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 you're holding back the real stuff. The real story is over here. It's beyond your evidence. Honestly, it's like trying to disprove religion. You're not going to be able to do it. It's a whole conspiracy is a whole belief system that works in similar ways to history, but instead of working on the presence of evidence as history does, it works in evidence's absence.
We'll leave it there for now. John, thanks a lot for joining us. That's John Pollock, history instructor and pop culture expert at Madison College. He joined us for a look at the release of long classified documents related to the JFK assassination. Right now, Congress is looking at expanding U.S. defense and security in space. Lawmakers working on the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, are working out the size of the Army, the number of aircraft and ships to buy, and they're also deciding whether or not to authorize a new Space Corps.
But the idea of a uniformed service for space has been controversial. Some say the U.S. needs to have a presence in outer space to conduct military operations today. Others say the current military structure can handle those operations.
Russell Berman is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. He recently wrote about whether or not the U.S. military needs a Space Corps. Russell, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, can you talk about whether we have a specific Space Corps or just do this via the military? What kind of operations, what kind of needs are seen for the military, the U.S. military in orbit?
Well, obviously, you know, that has a lot of satellites, and basically every element of warfare is fought through space in one way or another, similar to the fact that so much of what we do involves space, whether it's using the GPS on your phone or getting an up-to-the-second weather forecast. That involves space. And so everything the military does, whether it's defensive or offensive, in terms of capability, involves GPS, it involves satellites, it involves space. And so the debate is really a bureaucratic one, whether to create the first new uniformed service in the military in 70 years since the creation of the Air Force after World War II.
Who is calling for this change, and what's their argument for it?
So a bipartisan group of lawmakers in the House of Representatives are the drivers behind this. And the House, for the first time in their annual defense bill, included an authorization for the Space Corps, and that passed earlier this year. In the Senate did not include a Space Corps. They included just really one additional office in the Pentagon that would coordinate space policy. So a big difference in terms of bureaucracy. And so the House and the Senate are going to have to work out their differences, and we should know by the end of the year whether Congress actually creates a Space Corps or not. It's a big fight at the moment.
For those House members from both parties, as you say, who are supporting this idea, how are they making the case that we need this, in effect, separate entity within the U.S. military?
Well, it all goes to the idea that space just does not get the priority or the attention that it deserves right now, and that it needs culturally and bureaucratically its own separate service in the military. And these lawmakers point out that the Air Force, and this isn't really disputed that much, that the Air Force is really a fighter pilot service. It promotes fighter pilots. It's oriented around the fighter pilot. And so even though the Space Command, which has, I think, 36,000 personnel in it at the moment, is within the Air Force, it plays second fiddle to the traditional role of the Air Force as a fighting force in the air and not in space. And so they think that just basically, they don't even necessarily want to expand the Space Command so much as just move it out of the Air Force, give it its own power center in the military, and that will refocus the Pentagon's attention towards space in a way that it hasn't before.
Right. The argument seems to be it's the the forgotten branch of the Air Force. If people who are ambitious and want promotion, they become fighter pilots. Funding, you write, people are worried that funding to the space program, the space part of the Air Force, gets shifted in other directions. Is that what people are worried about?
Right, that they, you know, that the Space Command is used as a piggy bank, and so for whenever the Air Force needs to sort of backfill some funding for a new fighter jet or something like that, it takes from the Space Command, and that's just an indication of how low of a priority it is right now. And so the Air Force and the Pentagon are opposed to this, which is not surprising. Historically, the military does not like Congress dictating change. In fact, 70 years ago, when the Air Force was created out of the Army, it was the same type of fight, you know, bureaucratic meddling is what they accused Congress of doing. So that's what it's up against. But this is not a new idea. It's something that was first broached by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld before he became Defense Secretary a second time in 2000. But then it got kind of sidetracked after 9/11, as so many other things did as the nation refocused on the Middle East.
We're talking to Russell Berman from The Atlantic. He recently wrote about the idea of having a separate space corps, a separate command within the Air Force dealing with operations in orbit, in effect. And Russell, there's theorizing about what a space corps might have to deal with, whether it's a separate entity or not. What kind of attacks or threats are members of Congress and the military worried about?
So the concern is Russia and China, and it's not specific threats so much as that they, over the last several years, have upped their capability, and they, according to one of the congressmen I spoke to, they have near what was known as near peer status with the United States when it comes to space. And as with anything else, related to the military, the United States prides itself on superiority, and so the notion that Russia and China are catching up to us in capability is scary, frankly, for these members of Congress. And so one of the things that they blame is the fact that because space has not been a high enough priority in the military, we've allowed Russia and China to catch up, and so they could pose a threat either by, disrupting our satellites, if not, in terms of an outright offensive attack.
And the secondary concern is that disrupting these satellites, as you mentioned, these are key to military operations. So it might mean guidance systems for missiles, direction finding for, I guess, tanks and infantry units, all those sorts of things in the event of a conventional conflict could be disrupted a lot.
Right, exactly. As one expert pointed out, it's when we put a bomb on a target somewhere in the world, did that bomb come from space? Not physically, he said, but the bomb would not have gotten there without our space capabilities. So it's a space-enabled bomb, and that's basically every bomb that we drop in the theaters that we're involved in right now.
As you say, members of the House are leading the effort here, the Senate not including it in their defense authorization bill. How about the White House? What is the Trump administration saying about all this?
They've backed up the military and the Pentagon, which is formally opposed to this. They haven't issued a veto threat if it's included in the final legislation, and so that's an important distinction. And so from what the advocates of a new space corps say, and they expect that the military and by extension the White House will fight this, but if Congress is able to pass it over their objections, they expect that the administration will go along with it. In other words, it's not like they have drawn a line in the sand and saying that if you put this in the bill, we will veto it. They haven't done that yet. So that's why there is some hope that even though the administration currently opposes it, there might be something to be worked out.
And as you say, this doesn't mean if this separate command is created that more money would be devoted to space stuff. But it sounds like with the separate command that that piggy bank would be used only for the space stuff, not rated for other Air Force priorities.
Right. The funding would be secure, and there would be, you know, a relative to the amount of money that we spend on the military, would be a very modest uptick in initial, you know, cost of, you know, offices and uniforms and that kind of thing, but not a real big expansion in the size of the personnel or in directly in new military capabilities.
Now, you mentioned there's pushback from the military itself. What are the supporters of this saying to that pushback? Are they saying, okay, yeah, there's valid reasons, but we still think we're right? Or is it just this is standard bureaucratic pushback that we need to overcome?
More the latter. It's that the military always, and in bureaucracy in general, always opposes change, especially when it's dictated by Congress and sort of coming from outside. And in the military, they give this excuse a fair amount. You know, there's a big push to audit the Pentagon. It's never been completely done. And they say, well, we're involved in two wars right now, and it's now is not the time. And so the members of Congress point out, well, we always seem to be involved in a war. There always is a higher priority, but at some point we need to address this, and especially if they agree with the idea that space needs to be a bigger priority, then they need to come forward and, at the very least, put their own proposal on the table for making it a higher priority without creating a new uniform service.
We'll leave it there. Russell, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Berman, senior associate editor at The Atlantic. He joined us today to talk about calls for the U.S. military to create a separate space command. Now it's time for Food Friday. Our next guest knows a thing or two about creating a delicious dessert, so much so that it got him a job in the White House, baking pies and pastries for presidents, other world leaders, even the Pope. And while it would be easy to load up those desserts with a lot of fat and sugar, Chef Bill Yassas took a different and healthier approach.
He says that a good dessert doesn't need to lean on sugar and fat to be yummy, and by making some simple tweaks, we can create stunning, health-conscious desserts that are still capable of satisfying the sweetest of sweet tooths. In a new book, he shares some of his favorite recipes and advice to make desserts that you don't have to feel guilty about.
Bill Yassas was the White House executive pastry chef from 2007 to 2014, where he was involved with First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign. He's the founder and chair of the Kitchen Garden Laboratory and author of the new book, The Sweet Spot, Dialing Back Sugar and Amping Up Flavor. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write early in your book that a turning point for you in part was shortly after Barack Obama was inaugurated and First Lady Michelle Obama called a meeting of the White House cooking staff. What happened there and what changed for you as a cook?
Yes, absolutely. That was sort of a real big moment of kind of misunderstanding. I first thought, I must be out of here because she began to talk about healthier eating, but in fact, it was just the opposite. What she was advocating and what came to be was a program to get people to think about food, the source of their food, and eating in a healthier way. But it did not mean eliminating desserts or necessarily making them, you know, kind of diet-type desserts. What turned out to work well was to make good desserts, serve smaller portions, maybe less frequently, and just use great ingredients. And to do that, Mrs. Obama planted a garden on the South Lawn, and that sort of launched the whole trend of people growing gardens again, which is a great thing. But I did continue to try to follow this path and make desserts that were flavorful and delicious, but at the same time cut back on sugar and some of the fats.
And Bill, if you look through your cookbook, I was looking and, you know, there's a lot of recipes in there that will have a third of a cup of sugar or a quarter cup of honey. And it's not the 2 cups of sugar that I'm used to seeing in dessert recipes. You don't totally get rid of the sugar and it's not a different artificial sweetener. It's still sugar. But can we really get by with that little and it still tastes sweet?
Well, it was really shocking to us as we tested the recipes to see how how little sugar was necessary to make it still taste like a dessert and delicious. And the side benefit was that a lot of the other flavors came out more fully. So if you're making a lemon dessert or a strawberry dessert, those flavors came forward. And even the flavors of the flour or alternative grains like quinoa and millet and rye, those flavors came forward. And when we use nuts, for example, the almonds and hazelnuts flavors became more apparent. So that was kind of a revelation to me. And the way we did it was we cut back sugar way farther than we thought we would have to, just to get a baseline. And those, frankly, didn't taste that good. and then we would build it up from there till we started to get back to where closer to what we found to be the sweet spot. And it was amazing how really you didn't need that much. So in many cases, we cut the sugar back by 50%, and the dessert still tasted great.
How much do you have to compensate when you start cutting sugar at that level? How much do you have to make up for it with other flavors?
Well, thanks for that follow-up question, because it's important to realize that you can't just always just pull out the sugar. Sugar gives texture and structure to desserts as well. It's what holds them up. So we would replace it with sometimes healthier sweeteners like honey or agave, but also something else we discovered was we would use fruit purees. So we would cook down fruit puree or apples is kind of the most common one, and we found that the pectin in the apples and the fiber in the apples, as well as the natural sugar, brought a lot of structure into the dessert and made it hold up better.
And another way of putting this, you say that a chef's mantra should be treat sugar like salt. Can you get into more of that idea?
Yeah, that's what I say. And I want to make clear that I'm not talking about the same amounts, because very little salt is needed to bring the flavor out. But my idea is what we're aiming for here is not just willy-nilly put sugar into our desserts, but put the amount that brings the other flavors out without drowning them really in the sweet stuff. So that's why I say use sugar like salt, and that was our philosophy as we tested recipes for this book.
We're talking to Bill Yasis. He's a former White House pastry chef. He's the author of the new cookbook, The Sweet Spot, Dialing Back Sugar and Amping Up Flavor. Let's get into a recipe, one that you've shared with us. We've got this over at WPR.org, lemon curd pie with meringue. Before we get into the details of the recipe, I understand this was a bipartisan dessert.
Yes, you could say that. You could say that. In many cases, they all were, because I always say, well, I served both a Republican and a Democratic president. I served George W. Bush and Barack Obama. And if they agree on one thing, it's that they love peach pie. I think we should start every political conversation with the words peach pie, because it seems to bring people together. You'll notice that I sort of switched the name around. It's really a lemon meringue pie, but I wanted to use a different way of expressing it, because lemon meringue pie for me has always been way too sweet. The meringue on the top, even though egg whites don't need that much sugar to hold up, especially since you're baking them partway in the oven. And then the lemon itself, I think people had a sense that, well, it's sour, so we have to put a lot of sugar in. What we did in that recipe was pare things back, and I think we still hit it right on the mark. The lemon flavor comes out, you can taste the crust, and the meringue has a delicious flavor without being chewy from all the sugar.
Now, you talk about some of the ingredients that you'll need, and you've been talking a lot about flavors and sometimes compensating for the sugar that you take out, so you still have a complex, delicious flavor going on. And I was intrigued by some of your pantry items. Some of them, you know, sugar, honey, all of that, flour makes sense. But you also had some things that were unusual there. There was one called sakura syrup, I think. What was that?
Well, yes. And by the way, we do reach for some kind of exotic ingredients. And our theory there is that spices, herbs, and some of these kind of wild syrups, they lend interest to a dessert, and they kind of distract your palate from noticing that, well, there's less sugar in this dessert than I'm used to. So we call them distractors. But Well, there is pomegranate molasses is one of them. And then we do use some syrup, some Japanese syrups that you can find in Asian stores or online. But in every case, we also provide a alternative that is you can find in any grocery store. I think the interesting thing now is that grocery stores are starting to really stock a lot of these interesting flavors from the Middle East and South America and Asia. They have even special sections for each of those kind of cuisines. And you can find the rose water in the Middle Eastern section, or you can find interesting corns in the South American section. And so that's what I try to encourage people to do if they're adventurous. If not, we sort of provide an alternative along the way.
You also write about when you can, cutting back on the white flour, having healthier grains and flours in it. And I know sometimes I have some desserts where I think it's better with a whole wheat flour, and sometimes it's a disaster. It ruins it. Do you have a rule of thumb for when you just got to stick with the white flour and when you can use something else?
I agree with your comment there. Yeah, and that's so many times. I think it's the concept and the philosophy of health that drives the recipe more than the flavor. And what I tried to do was to make sure that it was flavor that was primary in all this. So what we did was we used these other grains such as millet or rye or buckwheat, and we use them in a relatively minor proportion. I think that would be my rule of thumb. 10 to 20% seems to be where they bring flavor, they bring another aspect to the dessert, but they don't overpower it.
It's Food Friday, and we're talking right now with former White House pastry chef Bill Yasis, talking about delicious desserts without quite as much sugar and some healthier ingredients. Bill's the author of the new cookbook called The Sweet Spot.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried dialing back the sugar in your baking and dessert making? What works? What has gone wrong? What ingredients do you look to get make up for some of the flavor you lose by taking out the sugar? Or do you have a question for a guest about how to make something a little, still delicious, still a yummy dessert, but a little healthier, a little less sugar? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can comment and find some recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Chef Bill Yasis, who says desserts don't have to have so much sugar to be yummy. And he's sharing some advice and recipes to satisfy your sweet tooth, but without quite as much guilt.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried to make dessert healthier? Was it yummy, or do your relatives shy away at family dinners when you try to offer to make the cake next time? Do you need advice on how to make yummy desserts with a little less sugar, maybe a little less fat? And you have questions about our guest's experience as a White House pastry chef? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post and find a couple of his recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our callers right now. We've got Tom joining us in Washburn County. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about maple syrup. We like to use it to substitute for things. And I know if you use honey, you got to kind of think of it differently from, using regular sugar. But I was wondering, if you could mention something about that. And I'll listen on the air. I'll hang up.
Thanks. Okay, Tom, thanks a lot. Asking about getting more maple syrup into the act. I like to sweeten my yogurt with syrup. Again, it's not... you're talking about the structure of it that sugar brings. What can you do with syrup, Bill?
Well, Tom has a great question there. Maple syrup is one of my favorite flavors. When you're baking with it, however, remember that there's also a lot of water in it, even the best maple syrup, it just naturally has, a big percentage of water. So what I like to do is to cook it down. Now, by that, I mean you put it under a low fire in a thick saucepan and just boil away the water. It evaporates out, and it gets thicker and thicker. Now, you can't leave it because eventually it'll get so thick it turns into like a rock. But this way, you're dealing with more of a thick syrup, so you're not adding too much water to your recipe. But even then, you should take some of the liquid out of the recipe. You just have to sort of judge it. Say you've added a cup of maple syrup and you've reduced it down to a half cup. You still have a couple tablespoons of water in there. That's why it's viscous. So you probably want to take a couple tablespoons of your whatever the liquid is, if it's milk, cream, butter, or any other liquid, you want to take a little bit out. Can I also say something about honey?
Sure.
I love honey, and it's one of the great flavors and also one of the great ways of nutrition or adding to our nutrition. But it is a strong flavor in dessert, so I rarely replace all of the sugar with honey in a dessert because as much as I love it, it just then becomes an all-honey dessert. I like to use it in proportion to the other things in the recipe so that it gives a hint of it but not overpowered.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Travis in Manitouish Waters. Travis, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to ask about?
I was wondering about how to make banana bread healthier rather than just using regular white flour and a whole bunch of sugar.
Travis, thanks for that call. And that's one where I can, Bill, use wheat flour and I'll sub in applesauce for some of the oil and sugar. Am I on the right track there?
Totally. I would do that, yeah. And I think that's it's one of my favorite recipes. Any kind of bread pudding is really popular with me. And so, I mean, if you really wanted to make it healthier, and this is something that, you know, I'm not dogmatic about. I mean, you could make a recipe with just the egg whites, because it's the egg white instead of the yolk that holds it together. You may cut back on the sugar, especially if your bananas are already, like, fully ripe. They get sweeter as they go, so that allows you to cut back on the sugar. And I do like your recommendation of using some of the alternative flours, the whole wheat or the quinoa or the emmer. All these things have kind of nutty flavors that really add to the finished product. And in this case, you don't have to worry about your dessert holding up because you have the bread already. So that's the kind of dessert I love, banana bread pudding.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much for that call, Travis. And I want to ask you about another recipe now, Bill, and this would be your high-percentage chocolate cookies. It's got a lot of stuff in there. They sound delicious. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, this was a recipe. I sort of started out with, we have, on the East Coast, we call them chubbies. I don't know if you have that same word. They're very chocolatey. They're like a chocolate chip cookie, but where the dough is chocolate as well as the chips. And what's unique about these is that there's very little flour in them. So I think in that recipe, there's only 2 to 3 tablespoons of flour, and the rest is pretty much chocolate. But the interesting thing about chocolate is even though when it's melted, it seems like a liquid, it actually does have a lot of fiber in it because it's made from the cacao bean, the bean of the cacao tree. And so they do hold together with very little flour. And for me, these cookies are really addictive. Right out of the oven, warm, it's just like a concentrated chocolate souffle. And they're very popular.
Thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to Bill Yasis. His new book is The Sweet Spot, Dialing Back Sugar and Amping Up Flavor. He's a former White House pastry chef. Back to your calls now. Carrie is on the line in Waukesha. Carrie, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Carrie?
So I'm a diabetic, which means I'm always looking for low-sugar, low-carb dessert options. And I came across a recipe for vegetarian chocolate mousse. And I used a higher quality dark chocolate, a very dark chocolate, and the juice from a can of chickpeas. You basically just whipped that juice from the chickpeas until it ended up like thickening just like egg whites. And then I added a little Cool Whip to it, and it was amazing.
You came up with that yourself, or you found that online, Carrie?
I found it online. Okay. I cheated and found it online.
No, that's great, because I was wondering who came up with that chickpea water idea. Have you heard of anything like that, Bill?
Absolutely. Chickpeas are having a moment now. And chickpeas themselves and chickpea flour are used. But the magical thing is that the water from the can whips up like meringue. And it's the craziest thing. I saw it somewhere, or somebody mentioned it to me. I couldn't believe it. And just like our caller, Carrie, you put it in the mixer as if it was egg whites, and you whip it like it was egg whites, nice clean mixer, and sure enough, it turns into a meringue, and a pretty sturdy one. And so if you don't want to add sugar, and so, you know, so a diabetic might add Splenda or another sugar substitute, and you have a darn good way to lighten desserts. That's the whole purpose of meringue, is include air in your recipe.
What does it taste like? Does it taste like chickpeas, or is it pretty neutral?
Mildly, but it's pretty neutral. It's that because you're forcing so much air into the mixture, into the meringue, that it takes away the chickpea flavor. Basically, it's just sort of like adding air and lightening the dessert.
Mm, what a great
idea.
I
mean, it's like a science experiment, you know? So it's
funny, man.
Because you're seeing that. One of the things I do, by the way, is outside of cooking, I do some educational classes on the science of cooking. And so what's happening is that there are the molecules in the liquid have what's called surfactants, so they are actually holding the bubbles more firmly that are whipped into it by the whisk, and they last a really long time.
Wow. Weird. I never would have thought that. Carrie, thank you for telling us about that. Let's go next to Linda in Stoughton. Linda, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about honey, and I know you already talked a little bit about it. But one of the things I've found is if you choose your honey wisely, it doesn't overpower the flavor. So a lot of the local wildflower honeys, rather than a red clover honey, which has a stronger flavor, I've found that it can be replaced. And I usually do about half the amount of honey to sugar in the recipe, and it works really well for baking. And I'm wondering... I wanted to make that comment, and then wanted to hear if your guest has any ideas about honey recipes.
Linda, thanks.
Oh, certainly. Thank you, Linda. I'm glad you bring it up because it is one of my favorite subjects, and I do like the suggestion of using sort of a local honey, a wildflower honey, or specifically, there's some kinds that are seasonal, like Tupelo honey, really fantastic flavor. So that gives me a chance to talk a little bit more and go into a little more detail about it. I agree that it depends on what honey you use. The other reason to use a local honey is that it becomes a sort of a natural way to avoid allergies, because think about these bees. What they're going to do, they're going all over your local area and picking out the pollen to make their honey, the nectar, but the pollen naturally comes. So when you eat a local honey that's not pasteurized, you're getting minute amounts of pollen from your own area. And what that does is inoculate you a little bit against allergies. So it's a really good thing for people who have allergies, and it's just in general a way to boost your immune system by using local, non-pasteurized honey.
And we're just about out of time.
Okay. Well, that's my comment.
Okay, you finished your honey ideas. Well, Bill, thank you so much. This sounds amazing, and I'm excited to try some of these. Thank you for talking with us today.
Thanks. It's great being here.
That was Bill Yassas, White House executive pastry chef from 2007 to 2014, where he was closely involved with First Lady Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, also the founder and chair of the Kitchen Garden Laboratory and author of The Sweet Spot, Dialing Back Sugar and Amping Up the Flavor. You can find a couple recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
This week, we've seen two companies move forward with ideas that are maybe pushing the envelope. In example number one, Amazon wants to use a so-called smart key and a security camera to allow delivery people to come inside your house to drop off the stuff you ordered.
And in example number two, Southwest Airlines is going forward with an expansion of its series of pop-up concerts on a plane. So to reiterate, live bands playing concerts on a plane it sounds better than snakes on a plane, I guess. Wait, what do you think, Rob?
I like live music. I don't like being a captive audience. The kind of things I like to do on a plane are read or sleep. So I don't know if I want to be forced into listening. And what about turbulence?
What if it was an Eagles cover band, your personal nightmare?
Yeah.
Yeah, that could go wrong in many ways.
Okay, and then there's the Amazon Key, they're calling it, where there's a system where you can, say the delivery person can unlock the door and come in and drop the stuff.
And you monitor them with a security camera from anywhere. I don't know.
Isn't there that thing, the hacking? Like, isn't this a thing?
There's the hacking thing.
I can imagine.
How could it go wrong?
Right, some obvious downside there. But maybe bring them together and just let random bands unlock the door to your house and show up and surprise you with the concert. That is a winning idea.
I like it. No, I don't like it.
I don't like it either. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.